lunch event today. My name is Enid Choi. I'm a board member and a member of the professional committee. First, a few housekeeping rules. Please turn off your mobile devices during the talk, or at least turn them to silent mode. And do take a look at our website for the many events that are coming up. October is going to be particularly busy. I mean, I'm going to just pick two of our many great events that are coming up to mention briefly. Jung Chang, the author of Wild Swans and the Unauthorized Biography of Mao, will be in town to discuss her new book on the Empress Dowager Cixi. So that's... So her talk is going to be on the 30th of October. And also the mega star and very popular speaker, Michael Palin, is returning to the club in late October. So keep an eye out for those flyers in your inbox and book early. Turning to today's topic, in 2012, the Hong Kong Diploma of Secondary Education replaced two sets of public exams, which were taken at ages 16 and 18 in Hong Kong. In addition, a four-year undergrad degree replaced the traditional three-year system, and these are enormous changes to Hong Kong's education system. And the British Council has conducted extensive research into the early indications of the reform's impact. The Hong Kong Director of British Council, Robert Ness, is the speaker today. He joined the British Council in 1981 and assumed his current position last December. Please join me in welcoming him to the club today.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Enid, particularly for the reference to the fact that I started the British Council in 1981. I was that high at the time. I'm delighted, honoured, and maybe a little daunted to be speaking to you this afternoon. I just thought Yong Chang, Michael Palin, Robert Ness, it has a good ring to it, you know. But an institution such as yours, where if I were to feel a little homesick, which I don't usually do, it's nice to know that I can pop in if I need to for a sample of Britain's national dish, by which I mean, of course, chicken tikka masala, just in case anybody's in any doubt. I look around the room and I see expertise, knowledge, wisdom, and I wonder whether I have been very foolish in agreeing to come and talk about this in the Lion's Den this afternoon. But I did actually want to say quickly what this is not going to be about, and then what it might be about. It's not in any sense pretending to be some kind of verdict on anything. It's not the job of the British Council guests in Hong Kong to pontificate to a home audience about their education system and reforms. But more than that, I would say, how could anyone be proposing a verdict, if you like, in a system which actually is really just beginning to find its feet? I mean, this is, in one sense, year one. So that's what it's kind of not about. But what it is about, I think, is about the data that has been collected at this early stage, about views that are being formed, and about discussions that are happening. And I do have to keep saying it's very, very early days. So it's a snapshot, really. It's a snapshot of perceptions, of experience, and of initial reactions. We did, my colleagues went to discuss it with the Education Bureau. They welcomed it, and they also welcomed the idea of further research at a later date. I do want to say something about the team who carried this out, that some of them are in the room. They're our education intelligence team. They sit in the British Council's office in Hong Kong, but they're not attached to Hong Kong operations, if you like. They could be sitting in Caracas. I'm sure they're happier to be sitting in Hong Kong, but that doesn't have to go on the record. Or they could be sitting in Berlin. I don't know how they'd feel about that. Because their work is global, really. They're sitting doing some desk research, some research on the ground, but they could be based anywhere. They happen to be in our office. We kind of like that, and we get a lot from them being here. But I say all that just to kind of get across the idea that they're not sitting poring over and scrutinizing events in Hong Kong every single day. The primary audience for the kind of research that they carry out and the work they do has tended to be in the UK. It's tended to be people working in higher education in the UK, but I think increasingly we know from tracking this that there's a much wider global audience of people who are interested in education developments, education reforms more globally, whether that's Turkey, where they were a week or two ago, or Saudi Arabia, France, or in this occasion, Hong Kong. Why Hong Kong? Well, for the obvious reason, these very significant, potentially far-reaching reforms are of great interest to the many UK institutions that have connections and interests and partnerships in Hong Kong, but wider than that too. My last posting was in Colombia, and I've been here about 11 months, and Colombia obviously shares not very much in common with Hong Kong, except perhaps both governments are focusing on education as a priority. So the differences are marked. Hong Kong boasts some of the world's top-rated universities, and it's pushing to further internationalize student population, faculty populations, and research collaborations. Colombia is more focused on simply widening access at primary and secondary schools, as well as a higher education internationalization agenda. So there are very many differences, and despite the varied stages of development, both governments share that core belief that education forges paths in an increasingly globalized, integrated economy and society. So working for the British Council here, which has as a major part of its focus education, it's got to be exciting. So the report is a product of our education intelligence team. Now, my own initial background research, by which I mean Wikipedia, led me to the opening sentence of the article in Wikipedia on education in Hong Kong. I don't know who wrote it, but this is what it says. Education in Hong Kong is largely modeled on that of the UK, particularly the English system. Now, if the person who wrote that's in the room, they got to get onto Wikipedia very quickly and change that, because it's obviously not at all true if it ever was. In fact, as a product of the Scottish education system, I can see very many more similarities with Hong Kong. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute, of course, that somehow or other Hong Kong reforms are modeled on Scotland, but there are more similarities in England. So Wikipedia entry writer, get out there and change that very quickly. You may have noticed, or you may not, that in our lovely document that we'll be presenting to you all as you leave, the title includes the word revolution. And you may think, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, isn't it? But is it? Imagine if you were in England, and many people here will be familiar with England in all sorts of ways. Imagine if the minister announced that GCSEs and A-levels were going to be scrapped and replaced by another exam at age 17, that the three-year degree was going to be abolished and there'd be a four-year degree. People would say, wow, that's a revolution. And I think it is, therefore, not unreasonable to say for shorthand that this is a revolution in Hong Kong. Changing a curricular methodology, implementing a new qualification, the HDSE that was mentioned, to replace two sets of exams. These are huge undertakings, and as was to be expected, the DSE was initially met, and perhaps still, with some trepidation on the part of students and parents, because it aims to test a different set of skills than in the past. For example, the introduction of the liberal studies curriculum, which everybody seems to have a view about, where non-traditional topics are covered, it does not focus on rote memorization, and that's quite deliberate. Students must conduct independent research projects, relying on their ability to generate ideas, problem solve, sometimes with a very limited amount of teacher supervision. That's also deliberate. So the old school model of knowing that if you spend X number of hours memorizing this, that, and the other, a good grade is likely to be guaranteed, is being dismantled. Students are being taught that in some cases, there is no right or wrong answer. which is something I know from personal experience. So in addition to curricular and examination changes, a four-year undergraduate degree has been introduced, an extension from the three-year system, a move which required Hong Kong universities to accommodate an entire additional cohort of students, which they did with great success and supreme efficiency. So the goal is that with more time to, as it were, declare a major, an additional year that might, for example, be spent in an overseas learning experience, a more well-rounded, outward-facing, if you like, student might emerge. And as enormous as the practical changes are in all this, the aim, the kind of pedagogical aim of these reforms are even greater. So in part, at least, to create an adaptable and versatile workforce able to adjust to the quickly evolving economy. I think it's actually instructive, certainly was for me, to look back at the official documents which were published in the year 2000 and which set out what all this was about. And I quote, "The overall direction of the education reform is to create more room for schools, teachers, and students to offer all-round and balanced learning opportunities." Then it says this, "We must address the inadequacies within the existing education system to enable the majority of Hong Kong people to achieve lifelong learning and all-round education. Despite the huge resources put into education and the heavy workload endured by teachers, learning is still examination-driven, and scant attention is paid to learning to learn. School life is usually monotonous. Students are not given comprehensive learning experiences with little room to think, explore, and create." So that's what was written in 2000, and it's pretty profound, I think, and it's in its own way, I think, quite inspiring. I'm nearly finished quoting. It goes on. "To enable every person to attain all-round development so that he or she is capable of lifelong learning, critical and exploratory thinking, innovating and adapting to change, filled with self-confidence and a team spirit." Now, these are very ideal sort of concepts and words, but you can very clearly see what the intention is. And on the EDB's homepage, it says simply, "The aim of education for Hong Kong is to promote students' whole person development and lifelong learning capabilities." So Hong Kong is setting out to effect a major realignment or readjustment. To what, you might ask? You could argue Hong Kong is at the top of its game, known throughout the Asia region as a financial services hub, competition with Singapore perhaps, but Hong Kong's white-collar workforce is well-trained, efficient, banks and financial service companies operating are top-notch and world-renowned. Now, we do actually employ people from the USA in our office, so they told me that there's an American adage which goes, "If it ain't broke, why fix it?" And certainly there are no alarms being triggered. In some ways, the opposite. If you look at Hong Kong's stellar school education performance in the international rankings as measured by PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment, then, you know, it's up there at the very top with Finland, with Singapore, with South Korea. So what's the problem, you might ask? But there's another aspect to all this. If you look at Hong Kong's not-so-distant past, the economic profile was quite different. And so what we're talking about is thinking about a student body, a product, a cohort, which may continue to have the kind of academic success that is measured by PISA, but also has an added set of dimensions, which, obviously, the people who wrote the paper in the year 2000 believe would add to Hong Kong's strengths and to their capacity and ability to contribute and thrive in the world economy. I'm going to skip that paragraph because it's very repetitive. I've just realized. But here we are. As a result of these circumstances, Hong Kong is aware of the need to be prepared for change, to generate a flexible, vibrant, creative workforce that not only has core knowledge in a variety of basic academic subjects, but an additional ability, if you like, to adapt. So, for example, the prospect of lifelong employment with one company, for example, somebody who's worked for the same organization since 1981, that won't exist in the future for many more of us. So that kind of change is yet another aspect of the flexibility that, in a sense, I think through the school and education system is attempting to be built in. But let's go back to the reforms. So the Education Intelligence Team, that's the British Council's Global Higher Education Research Service in our office, took on the task of quantifying the impact to date, and I keep saying it's very, very early days, of the reforms. So they did this in a number of ways, including disseminating a survey to gauge local student opinion of the HKDSE qualification and their higher education prospects. And nearly 2,800 students responded, so it's a very substantial pool from which to generate opinion and statistics. Importantly, many other stakeholders were consulted and their views canvassed. Often of these are more anecdotal, but I think they're very important. The results and the other analysis are all contained in the report that we'll be very pleased to present to you today. But the findings are quite varied and nuanced. So for brevity's sake, I want to extract a few of what we think are the broad top line findings, and perhaps you won't be surprised by many of these at all. For example, Hong Kong students, by and large, want to study in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is their preferred location, which is interesting when you think how many of them go to other countries to study for all sorts of reasons. What else? Young people are recording that they see the value of what's called non-traditional subjects here, but I think what we mean by that is beyond the more obvious, and no doubt incredibly important and useful, subjects that tend to be the favourites: business, law, engineering. What else? So more students are being educated in the system for a longer time. That's interesting. The new system is perceived to be making Hong Kong students more valuable in an overall workforce. And this is reference to the development of so-called soft skills. The perception is that Hong Kong students will become even more competitively active in the global work marketplace as a result of the acquisition, or the addition, if you like, of these broader soft skills. An increasing number of students now aspires to be educated beyond secondary school. So that too has its challenges. And yet, interestingly enough, Hong Kong students, the ones who've just done, as it were, the DSE, don't yet see that the new educational philosophy has had an impact on them in terms of broadening their horizons, thinking analytically, being more independent in their studies and so on. They still focus on the centrality of exam results, and who can blame them, given the competition for places in higher education. So, okay, we're talking about capturing opinion at a time when the impact of the reforms are still being understood and absorbed, and it's early days. We're eager to conduct the same research in a few years' time to follow up when the impact has been more firmly felt, and other people are carrying out research. For example, they're looking at how Hong Kong DSE students are faring at British universities. So we know, for example, that admission to British universities with the DSE is not a problem. That's straightforward, and the DSE has been through very rigorous analysis and as it were, plotted. So that's okay. So how do DSE students fare? So that kind of thing is being researched as well. Some of the kind of anecdotal side is in some ways most interesting, and that's where it's recorded that there's definitely been a shift in terms of how education is viewed. The team interviewed education officials, university administrators, secondary school principals, headmasters, parents, agents, as well as students themselves. And in a number of areas, they reported changes, some marked, and some more subtle. And of course, it is important to remember that some important respondents, not least the students themselves, don't yet report any significant sense of change, which is something. But, you know, why would they? What are they comparing it with? They didn't do the previous system. They're only doing the DS. You know, it's a kind of, you're asking them what's changed. What are they comparing it with? So people who know about methodological approaches to statistics and all the rest of it can tell me about that later. But what about the university engineering professor who, accustomed to traditionally introverted, I'm quoting students, told us that the new DSE students speak up more in class. They write longer papers. Quote, they're just more curious, he said. Or the student who complained about her independent research project, because an aspect of the curriculum is to require students to undertake an independent inquiry study. This student, without realizing it, you might say, was strengthening her soft skills by thinking up a creative topic, going out into the street to interview people on the topic, compiling a lengthy report with results, but didn't register that this was somehow of value. Or the parent who noted that her daughter had not flourished in the traditional teach-to-test academic system, but that her interests elsewhere, say in hospitality studies, would be better recognised in an environment where young people weren't simply all encouraged to think in one particular direction. So as I've mentioned above, one of the most significant findings is that young people are being educated for a longer time. In the old system, students could opt out at various stages in their secondary school education. Now that option doesn't exist. And with, at least in theory, a less test-based environment, further enriched with opportunities to explore more creative subjects, students who may not have succeeded academically a few years ago are encouraged to remain in schools for other reasons. Of course, admission to one of Hong Kong's elite universities remains a huge challenge, considering that there are only 15,000 places. At the same time, we've noted in the research that the aspiration to gain a university degree has increased markedly, so there's a challenge inherent in all that. So equally, DSE students are interested in opting for a sub-degree, which for some of them might allow the opportunity, will allow the opportunity to apply to a Hong Kong university later in the cycle, or perhaps seek a university place overseas. In any case, no matter what the actual academic outcome, producing individuals with greater aspirations in education is of infinite value, whether in Hong Kong or anywhere else. I thought in conclusion, whilst avoiding any crass comparison with the UK, I did think back to the heady days of 1996, 1997, and the rise of Tony Blair and his government with the mantra of education, 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 the idea to invest in an education experience that would encourage more students, to think creatively and truly extend themselves. But maybe as a footnote, this is where I can indulge myself, that the policy may have been more focused on England than Scotland. I can talk about that privately later. I wouldn't dare say any more from here. And in any case, in the UK, and actually particularly in England, the debate rages, and rages is actually in some cases the appropriate word. So heated debate about education, whether in Hong Kong or anywhere else, is absolutely to be expected and is the norm. So back to Hong Kong. I suggest that what our research seems to be demonstrating, even allowing for the caveat that it's very early days, that if you look back to the official Hong Kong paper published in 2000 and to discussions around that time and to subsequent policy papers, if you examine the aims of the reforms, if you think about what all this hard, difficult, admirable intellectual effort set out to achieve, then, allowing that it's only year one, according to our correspondents, and particularly looking at the qualitative side of the debate, things are on track. No doubt, I'm just about to hear why they're not, perhaps, and why and what kind of challenges remain, but that's what the initial research seems to suggest. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Robert. We've got about 17 minutes left. Do you want to stay here or do you want to sit here?
What would you like?
So that we've got a bit of time for questions from the floor. Anybody? I see one hand there. A gentleman over there, please.
Okay, it's Roy Allen here. Okay, down here. Semi-retired teacher, and I've been here longer than you, so. you have tended to say quite a lot about the students at the top.
Students,
and,
yeah.
And aspirations, but I was here and teaching when the reforms were first broached in 2000, the talks that went before them, the talks that came after. And I remember very definitely the government trying to sell the program. And one of the pillars of their approach was that the new program would be much fairer. It would put much less pressure on the weaker students. Now, in the old system, students would take their school cert exams if they could get there. Actually, it's 17, not 16. It was 17 years of age. They did have the option to retake, to resit, and many students would take, if not all of them, some of the subjects again, key subjects like maths, English, Chinese, whatever. They also had the option at that stage to decide a pure academic approach, taking A-levels, wasn't for them, and there were many other options out there. The new system, though, forces students to stay at school for 3 years before they take their first and only ever examinations. And they have almost no chance whatsoever to resit. And my experience with students, parents, teachers, all round, is that the level of pressure on the weaker students is thus actually much greater. Now, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not asking you to sort of respond directly to all of that, but I'm interested as to whether or not, in collecting data, you actually had viewpoints that went to this and actually, you know, informed you on this
area. I just
area.
Didn't quite hear the second bit. Could you repeat that last bit? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm interested not so much in asking you for a judgment, because we understand that's not your purpose, but whether or not in collecting the information that people have actually been looking at the pressure on the weaker ones rather than looking at the kids at the top who are going to get to the universities anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask somebody else to comment in a minute, because I have the luxury of the actual team who carried out the research in the room, but I'm pretty sure that there was no discrimination in the sense of looking at particular groups, whether they're weaker or stronger or not. There was a survey of students who commented. But is that right? Let me ask some of my beautiful assistants to comment from over there on the actual research and whether that point was,
you know, there's no, my name is Anna and I work for the education intelligence team that Bob was mentioning before. I mean, there's no question that competition still exists. I mean, it's absolutely, and I'm American, and if you've read about the education system in the United States, it is very pressured there as well. So I see your point, and the kids that are less academically adept will always be under pressure. I agree. But I think the point of the research, what we found with the research, and we spoke to many students, is that I think they can see that maybe a broader range of, I don't know, abilities may be appreciated. I mean, it may not translate to a better grade, for example, better marks, but I think to stop focusing on those traditional subjects that Bob was talking about, but to sort of embrace, for example, that young girl that we spoke to who went out and did an independent project. She kind of stepped out of her comfort zone and exercised those new muscles. I think it's the development of a person, and maybe somebody that you're referring to who is not academically very strong might thrive in that kind of environment where they're asked to do things that are non-traditional. So I agree with you completely. I think that the pressure remains, and the kids we spoke to kids from age 16 to 21, 22, they have all agreed it is tough. It's tough here, it's tough in the United States, it's tough in the UK, and it would be great if there could be accommodation for kids that are academically less successful, but it's a competitive employment. Bob was mentioning that it may be interesting to see how employers view these kids, if the kids that come out of this new system who go to university and graduate, if they do those soft skills translate to maybe better employees. I mean, maybe that's the ultimate success benchmark than how well you do at university or how well you do in secondary school. So your point is very well taken, and all we can say about the students is they're under pressure, but a wider skill set is being examined right now.
Thank you for elaborating, Anna. I think I saw a hand over there. Thank you.
Just a very quick question. I wonder if the question is we're interested in your sampling effort and method also. How did you reach your target group? I think that is the question in issue, and I agree with Robert that. It would be very interesting, would be very useful to really trace the performance of this new group of intake compared to the previous HKALE candidate and also those admitted with non-JUPAS qualification.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds most interesting.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, just on that second part before Anna jumps in, I mean, I think this is where, things will begin to crystallize. So when you actually when you're able to track people's success or performance over 4, 5, 6, 10 years, and indeed how employers respond to that, inverted commas, new workforce.
Gentleman on the right.
Thank you. Yeah, my name's David Coles. I work as an educational consultant in this town, but perhaps more pertinently, I work with the Education Bureau as an inspector during this period of transition. When you say that this is the first year, yeah, it's the first year of the actual HDSE, but it's something like year 8, 9, 10
sure.
of the so-called revolution in pedagogy, which is supposed to lead up to the HDSE and then into the four-year university course.
Yep.
From my experience of what's happening in classrooms, the students who said to you, not much has changed, say that because not much has changed. And the pedagogy, which was designed to get kids through examinations, is still there. Yes, there is some liberalization in liberal studies and also in terms of learning to learn, critical thinking, and so on. But it's at the margins. For the most part, Hong Kong classrooms now are what Hong Kong classrooms were like 10, 12 years ago. And I think it's going to be a long time before you see the major shift.
Sure, I
there will be factors involved in that, some to do with training and so on.
Yeah.
But underlying it is a deep conservatism amongst parents, teachers, and consequently, students.
Sure. Thank you. Do you advise the or work with the EDB now, David?
I actually work with the EDB through... actually working on some of their reports in English, so okay. I'm pretty up to date with what's happening.
Yeah, no, what I meant was whether they're hearing it from, as it were... The
they're not hearing it from me, but...
they'll be hearing it.
They haven't been asking me.
And the lady in front?
Rachel Cartland. I do lots of different bits of voluntary work at the moment, and one of the things I do is I go to... girls' school once a week and going there this afternoon to do English conversation with them. And these are very able girls selected and so on for academic ability. But, I talk about them all sorts of different things. And a little while ago, I was asking them how many hours of sleep they got each night. And the answer is incredibly little. I mean, far too little for health, basically. So then I went and asked them why, and few would admit it was time on Facebook. They said it was all because they had to work so hard. So I said, well, so what are you working so hard on? And they've got, I guess it's part of the liberal arts curriculum things. And the topics they were doing seemed to me incredibly difficult. These were girls of 15 who were being asked to put something together on the government's issue of free-to-air television licenses and the controversy with ATV. I could do it probably, but it seemed to me that was even. There are some very able girls there who can more or less cope with that range of question. But I think I get back to this question about how about the weaker vessels and
sure.
this competitiveness and so on, and this thing that actually still. people are being really taught what to say, because those poor girls couldn't actually really... I mean, how can a 15-year-old come up with a meaningful thought about a broadcasting licensing framework, eh?
I couldn't. No comment. Not about licenses, anyway, or free-to-air ones.
But I wonder if you don't feel that perhaps, which I think this gentleman is sort of implying, that in some ways it looks very good, but it's that perhaps the reality is not quite as, can't be as good as the shiny the shiny semblance.
I mean, I do take the point that David made as well. I mean, I realise this is not year one. It's year one in one sense, and it's year 8, 9 or whatever. And I think those colleagues of mine who are actually involved in teacher development, teacher training as well, I mean, I imagine that those may be the kind of discussions that they have too with EDB. I don't know. But I mean, I take the point. There's no, it's unrealistic possibly to expect people of a certain age and experience to be tackling themes about...
It's got a little bit of resonance with what Michael Gove seems to be doing in the UK, that if you make people learn very... If you give people exams and very difficult things that they can't...
Yeah.
Mind you, just to throw in a quick anecdote, I mean, I talk to, as a journalist, you know, political activists in Hong Kong, and there is this feeling that youth participation in Hong Kong politics, you know, we're not just talking about the few kids who have joined scholarism and were very active during the national education scandal, but in general, kids are more eager to participate, and a lot of people put that down to liberal studies.
Sure, yeah, that's interesting. It's whether this is entirely relevant or not, but it is interesting reflecting that whereas generalizing like crazy, you know, there's sort of sense of some of the philosophy underneath the reforms here about moving away from memorization and so forth. Somebody mentioned Michael Gove, who is the education minister in the UK, responsible for England and Wales, and he actually wants much more memorization. So maybe he should come and have a chat with people in the EDB.
Any other questions? Gentleman on the left.
Hi, my name is Case. I recognize David over there. I'm an independent consultant. At that time of the educational reform, I was vice president of the Hong Kong Institute of Education. I was actually involved in the AIMS development subgroup. So I'm very pleased to hear you've been saying that things are on track. Yeah. And as David said, actually the reform starts not only by now, but actually by 2000.
Sure.
There was an education reform, and there was a curriculum reform after that. And now the 334 is what we call an academic structure reform. So as an independent consultant going around schools, including Maggie's, I've been seeing changes in the classrooms. Especially compared to today's where learning is very passive. Nowadays, as the convener said, there are more projects, more interaction in the classrooms, and students are more used to group work in schools. So things are changing, although there are still a room for improvement. But over the 13 years, I've been seeing the hard work of many teachers, and classrooms are getting different and different. And there are two major outcomes of this new curriculum reform. One is the development of generic skills, high-order thinking, communication, problem-solving, as you've mentioned. But then another big area of outcome is values and attitude. So may I ask, in terms of values and attitude change, has the research looked at that, and are there any changes in students' values and attitudes, become more responsible, more respectful, become more interested in studies, so on? So maybe this would be another aspect which is worth pursuing, because the reform look at two major changes aspects. So.
I don't think the work looked at that, but that might be something to look at. But you can see how foolhardy I am standing up here talking about it when there are people who actually know about it in the room. So, you know.
The lady put her hand up first.
I would like to speak on behalf of the so-called ethnic minorities in Hong Kong. As a parent, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but the other day, the chair of the EOC said he's looking into investigating the educational system in Hong Kong on the fact, on the allegation, that there is a policy of segregation, segregating the ethnic minorities in Hong Kong because of the introduction of the single language stream. I think this goes as far back as the 2000. Did you ever consider this? It is a fact. I, being a parent of two Filipino kids born and raised in Hong Kong, had this difficulty of getting them into the mainstream because of this policy. What can you say about this? What do you think? Is this really a fault that we have to address?
I have no. I mean, I can understand, you know, what you're saying and where it's coming from, but I can't say that our research of the sort of generic nature that we did was able to or would have looked into something like that. But that's not to say it isn't worth looking into, but this particular piece of work wasn't really focusing on that. It's looking just much more generally across the system.
I'm afraid we've only got time for one more question. So, gentleman on the right, please.
Hi, Michael Gibson. I'm treasurer of one of the international schools in Hong Kong. If all these reforms are working so well, and I'm only talking about the primary and the secondary here, why is are the waiting lists at the international schools ever increasing, in particular from local parents?
Yeah, well, did I say they were working so well? No, I think I said, you know, here are some indications, here's some research, here's where it might be going. I think we also said, you know, that right at the beginning that there is trepidation amongst parents, and, you know, so it's not at all surprising. But I don't think one thing or the other suggests it's working very well, therefore I don't know why you have these long lists, or it's not working at all, which explains. I think it's too early to say. I think parents have responded because possibly they haven't yet got confidence in the system. I don't know. Anna wants to say something. Is that all right, Chair? Could somebody give a microphone to this lady over here, please? Oh, shout.
The mics have disappeared, so yeah, maybe you can just speak loudly.
Getting into university in the US or the UK. So I see your point, those waiting lists are very long, but I think being a parent myself of children who are going to international schools, that the motivations are a bit different. And I'm not quite sure if that's exactly a reflection of how parents feel about the DSE. I would say there, among parents who can tend, believe me, I know, tend to be a paranoid bunch, that the introduction of a new test is quite intimidating. And I think maybe some students that we did speak to switched pathways as a result of not wanting to take that test. But I do think that the long lists at the Hong Kong International School, the Canadian School, et cetera, the motivations of those parents and that community are not directly a reflection of how they feel about the new system here.
I think, could I just add, I mean, I think it is true, and some of the respondents did say that they had decided to sit other exams, and that probably means the IB, and because of their lack of confidence, yeah. But that doesn't mean to say the reforms are good or not good yet.
I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thank you, Robert, for a very interesting session. You had a tough crowd out there.
They know far too much.
But here's a little souvenir to show our appreciation.
Thank you very much.